Hi everyone, and welcome to the Rexilon podcast. I'm Kirby Lachrunji.
And I'm Dawn Riddler. Every week we bring you the highlights, lowlights, and musings around the global econo-political environment that we feel might impact on your wealth.
Week number 15, 2024. And this week, lots happening in markets, EU and rates, China exports. We're speaking about Vietnam that have just given out a death sentence for a white collar crime. Dawn has written a fascinating piece around the creation of credit and what that means for the world financial system. And we're going to be talking a little bit about its application today, especially with the creation of vast amounts of credit in the international system. Zimbabwe, their new currency, which is gold back, called the ZiG currency. And then I've written a piece called Mixed Signals, which we're going to talk about as well a little bit later in the podcast. Just on the week, the Dow Jones down 2.37%, the S&P 500 down 1.56%, still up 7.41% year to date. If we go across into the Euro Stoxx 50, that is down 1.21% on the week, and year to date, that is up 9.57%. If one goes across further into the East, the Nikkei is up 1.47% as their currency continues to devaluate. Year to date, that market is now up 18.24%. I don't think the Nikkei hasn't seen this kind of action for a very, very long period of time. Shanghai down 1.62% on the week, and then China A50s down minus 2.59%. On the currency front, US dollar versus the Rand, 18.86. Great British pound, 23.49 against the Euro, 20.05. And then Bitcoin at just over 67,000 US dollars. We're going to talk about bonds as well a little bit later on today, and just about how the yields have escalated post the inflation print in the United States. But Dawn, perhaps before we look at the smaller issues, I think there's this fascinating piece that you've written around the history of credit in the international world and then with its application. You also talk about a book written by a gentleman by the name of called David Graeber. I hope I'm saying it right. It might be, perhaps it's Graeber, and it's called Debt: The First 5,000 Years, which really looks at how credit works and why it is so important for the international world. Dawn, what is your main take around the creation of credit and how currencies work?
All of us take money for granted and take debt for granted and take credit card for granted. It's just fascinating to sort of begin to understand a little bit behind how and why it works. And I just want to tell you a short story that really started my whole fascination with what is money and what is debt and how is money created? You know, how does the whole dynamic work? I have written about it, but, you know, we're going back probably nearly 4 or 5 years. A man came into a B&B. And he put down £100 on the desk and he said, "Will you just hold this £100? I want to just have a look at your sea-facing room and see whether I like it. And I just want to sit on the balcony and because I might come and stay here for a couple of weeks." And the guy said, "Sure, fine. You go up there." So now there's this $100 bill sitting on the counter. So he goes into the back room and leaves the bill there. And his wife comes in, sees the £100 and picks it up, goes to the hairdresser and says, "You know, I'm really sorry. I know that I'm in arrears with you, but here's $100 towards my bill." And the hairdresser says, "Cool." And she goes out, and the hairdresser then goes next door to the butcher and says, "Look, I've got £100. I can pay off my debt, you know, for all the meat that I've been buying." And then the butcher goes to, and so it goes on, and everybody goes around, and eventually we get to the stage where maybe the banker goes to his favorite call girl and said, "You know, thank you very much for running my credit, and, you know, here's the £100 that I owe you." And she walks back into the B&B, and, you know, by this time you've got this innkeeper there, so what on earth has happened to my £100 note that I left on the table? And she came in and put the £100 on his table and said, "Here's, you know, thank you very much. And here's my, you know, I paid for the room, you know, that my room bill," which has been accumulating over the last few months. Just as she does that, the guy comes from downstairs and he says, "You know what? I don't really like it." Picks up the £100 bill and leaves the room. But, you know, nothing has happened as far as he's concerned. But in the background, there's no debt anywhere anymore, except perhaps the innkeeper who's out £100. But the whole, you know, from a the movement of money is, I just think, is absolutely funny, fascinating. And I never realized why Nixon, in fact, took the US off the gold standard. And it was because being on the gold standard, they were running, they were going to run out of gold in order to keep the supply of money going. So then we start to get into the realm that we have deal with, and we talk, you and I talk about the whole time, which is the creation of money through, to all intents and purposes, central governments producing debt.
Yeah. I mean, I find that the creation of credit, the understanding of money over time, really also perhaps has got to do with who we are as individuals, the kind of and socioeconomic world in which we find ourselves, and how conservative we want to be around the creation of capital. I mean, Bretton Woods, which really introduced the gold standard, was an answer due to the Second World War. The Second World War was in part created because of imbalances in economic systems across the world and across different countries. And then by default, it created nationalism. And as that nationalism got created, this was then the start and the advent of the Second World War. And the world wanted to try and move away from that. That's why the Bretton Woods Accord really created the gold standard at the end of the day. So these are all good things. I mean, you know, nothing wrong with that. Just the only thing that they just didn't know is that because gold is finite, and because you can only hold so much gold, because it's a finite resource, you linking your currency against it means that ultimately you'll either start racking up inflation in a very, very large way, which was what Nixon sat with in the very early 1970s, or alternatively, you're going to have to curb your amount of trade. But the problem is that you can't, because your population is continuously expanding in the economy. And as they expand, they are going to require services, they're going to require products, and just a general standard of living. If you don't have those things, well, you're going to create nationalism in any case. And that's why they detach themselves from the gold standard, which is why today most countries are free floating. And by default, these free floating currencies across the world is a byproduct of a specific economy's fortunes and the way in which they run their own internal fiscus and how they run their own internal balance sheet, so to speak. And if you're bad at it, then your currency should depreciate. And if you're good at it, your currency should appreciate against all other currencies around the world. Obviously, the US dollar has played, in the post-Bretton Woods world, has played a very dominant role. And its dominance, really, Dawn, has been created through the euro dollar market. The Americans realized that the homegrown dollar is not going to be enough in order to create stability to global trade. So they created the euro dollar market. The euro dollar market is much larger than the domestic dollar market in the United States. And it really is there for the global free trade of goods and services right across the world. So if you are buying something out of China today, or you're importing goods from Europe, you are invariably going to be doing business with the euro dollar market, even if you don't think you might be. Along the way, you'll be doing business with the euro dollar market. And pretty difficult to unseat this stuff. This is the way in which this thing works today. And it's supposed to be free floating, and it's supposed to be to take all countries into consideration and their own fortunes and how they're running their own economies.
I mean, obviously, as South Africans, you know, we're acutely aware of the depreciation of the rand over the years because we deal with it. But what I found fascinating, and I mean, I've probably known it intuitively, is how much they've allowed the yen to depreciate recently, almost 50%. Am I right, Kubi?
Yeah. So, and this is just because the government continues, is no longer defending the yen. So they're now allowing for it to depreciate just because they want to become more competitive from an international perspective. So Japan has been, really speaking, a basket case from an economical perspective. If it wasn't for a central bank that defended the currency, manipulated the bond market, Japan would have gone through a catastrophic economic meltdown. post their 1990s property boom. They just never allowed for it to clear out the system. And then you've had this very lackluster world in Japan where nothing has worked, nothing has really grown. Things have really just kind of flatlined in Japan. Much like compound this problem, you've also sat with an aging population, which not really is contributing towards the economy like younger fellows or their younger counterparts would be doing. So you've had this double whammy, so to speak, and suddenly the Japanese are now at a point where as yields are moving higher and higher globally, they are no longer able to just defend their bond markets at very, very low interest rates. They have to allow for them to structurally move higher. Otherwise, people are literally just going to wholesale sell Japanese bonds and move money across into US treasuries. So suddenly you see manipulation of markets can only work so long. And then things start fragmenting and start falling apart. And this is what is happening in Japan as we speak. That's why they're starting to abandon all these things. So you can see them. I don't want to defend the currency. Let it free flow. Which is back again to a post-Bretton Woods world. They're just living the post-Bretton Woods world. Dawn, what I'm finding fascinating, though, is that if you look at the United States and you look at the level of debt in the United States, I'm talking about governmental debt, much of that is just escalating and escalating and escalating. Back in the Americans' minds, I think they're looking at it and saying, okay, we're going to make sure that from a GDP perspective, the GDP is going to grow in excess of what our interest repayments are. If we can get that right, then, well, we're back on a sustainable path of growth, because that means that we can use our growth in order to repay our debt. At the moment, those things are out of kilter at this stage. And that's part of the reason why they are trying to kickstart the economy all the time. They're trying to do the things that are required to kickstart the economy. That being said, they've got this huge yield curve of that is busy maturing at the moment right across the yield curve. So you've got tons of bonds that are busy maturing, and they're having to refinance those, reissue those. And you've obviously got the Treasury at the same token. If they can't issue enough bonds, that are issuing treasuries on the short end of the curve on a continuous basis. All of this, obviously, is debt creation, more and more and more debt creation, because you're issuing more and more of these bonds and these bills as you continue along the way. And the Americans will, if it continues like this, will at some point have their moment of reckoning. And remember, this is the reserve standard for the world. Now, look, people have been calling for this moment of reckoning since the 1960s and the 1970s. So don't hold your breath. My suggestion is, if there's anybody that likes to see the future amongst anybody listening to this, don't broadcast it too much when you think this might happen, because you're probably going to be wrong. But that ultimately could potentially start happening at some point.
And what is really interesting, you know, because dollar has really almost become, it is the reserve currency. The yen used to be a reserve currency, clearly not anymore, but yep. It is now the sort of new gold, as it were. With all this maturing of bonds and everything else, it's interesting to see how gold has actually also increased in price, and Bitcoin as well, you know, which are sort of new kind of reserve currencies, like they always have been. And it's a very volatile and very difficult market to try and trade in from an investment perspective. I mean, a lot of the reading that I did over the week, you know, they were talking about shorting treasuries at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, look, ultimately, let's assume the Americans get a handle on their debt, the US economy. They get a handle on their debt. They no longer have to do the issuance that they do. The economy continues to grow and starts growing post the rate of repayment as far as debt is concerned. Then suddenly the luster of any other alternative, such as a Bitcoin or gold or any other cryptocurrency, starts waning. People will start taking money out of those and put them back into greenbacks, because people would say, but this is becoming more sustainable now over time. Because you see, if the Americans continue doing this, you will ultimately have stagflation, which you've written about during this newsletter. There'll be stagflation at some point if this just continues and continues along this way. It might be quite a long way out, but stagflation will ultimately be the fruit that one picks from this. If one gets the growth rates going, that's a different story, though, because suddenly you're not going to need a cryptocurrency anymore.
And interesting, you know, bringing us to the ZiG, the Zimbabwe gold dollar that, yeah, you know, sort of, what is it, Zimbabwe dollar 0.1.356, right? You know, so
Yes.
look,
Yeah. Yeah.
this may just be a flash in the pan. They do it for a couple of months, it doesn't work, and they throw it in. You know, I just find it's quite interesting that they're doing. I think it's fairly foolish. If Argentina is looking at potential dollarization and they're a very much bigger country, you know, Zimbabwe should actually just suck it up and understand that they're not going to have their vanity project, their Zim dollar, which is hardly a vanity project. I mean, it's a laughing stock of the world. I mean, you go into,
Sure.
you know, houses all over the place and you'll see a 1 trillion Zimbabwe banknotes used as decoration because they're worth 10 cents or something.
Look, Zimbabwe is a basket case, and this is their attempt to try and create some currency that could at least just be tradable on an international basis. It's gold-backed. It's a Zimbabwe currency that's gold-backed called the ZiG. And ultimately, look, Dawn, once it's gold-backed, at least you'll create some stability because there'll be a price stability for this thing, you know, backed with physical gold. The problem, though, is that you might create currency stability, but you're not going to create a fertile ground for economic growth, because you're going to continuously be hampered by the amount of gold reserves that you can hold inside the currency, the country. And all of those reserves is hampered by their own inability to be able to hold and hoard capital and cash inside the economy. So you're going to continuously be hampered. So you can't achieve your economic growth prospects and your economic growth objectives as a country doing this. But yes, you could create some stability, you know, as far as your currency is concerned. If I was a Zimbabweans, I'd go scrap all of this, scrap the ZiG, scrap the Zimbabwe dollar, dollarize like the Argentinians. Say, listen, fair tender in this country is US dollars. You may use that and be done with it, you know, absolutely be done with it. But you see, there's something else happening in, you know, you don't have a free and open electoral system in Zimbabwe. You've got all these smoke and mirrors happening. So pretty certain that this is another element of that that's busy playing itself out. But goodness knows, you know, Zimbabwe is a, you know, will they ever fix Zimbabwe? Dawn.
Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe not in our lifetime, say.
Now, Kubi, we have talked a little bit about the Fed, but inflation remains sticky in the States. And, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before, and probably we're talking about inflation prints that are the new normal. They're going to be higher for much, much longer. Yeah. We're not going back to, you know, 1% or whatever, that, you know, sort of maybe around about 3 to 4% is the new normal.
Yeah, I mean, so that Fed inflation target of 2%, I think is something, is a bit of a pipe dream at this stage. Inflation on a year-on-year basis has just accelerated by 3.5%. The hope was for it to accelerate by 3.4% year-on-year, but it's up at 3.5% year-on-year. And obviously, the big fear now amongst market participants and just generally, you know, people in government is, look, what happens if inflation continues to escalate again? You know, where do we go from there? Is it, you know, we don't want to sit with the world going, especially into an election year, where inflation goes and sits up at 6 and 7% again. So you've got the Federal Reserve sitting on the background of this saying, listen, we're happy to drop rates, but later, you know, let's just get a handle on this whole thing. Let's just make sure this whole thing works the way that we think it should work. The problem that you've got is that you've got geopolitical tensions right across the world. You've got Ukraine continuously happening. You've got Israel and Gaza happening. You've got Iran that could potentially join that world. You've got chip wars happening between China and America. All of this economic wars that are happening is creating a higher inflation base. And that is part of the reason why I'm continuously saying that 2% inflation is one where we've got a world where products can freely trade across the whole world. And it's a world where the Japanese made a name for themselves in last minute manufacturing. That world is now gone. We're now sitting in a much more fragmented world. And in a much more fragmented world, inflation will run higher. The problem that you've got is from an asset management perspective, and this is what a lot of people are doing at this stage, is saying, well, okay, so if inflation is going to be higher, but what is the cost of capital then? And what should I put into the model as far as cost of capital so that that can influence my valuations as far as equities are concerned or cash is concerned, for instance? You know, would you rather buy a company with a dividend yield of 4.5% Or would you rather just put it into short dated treasuries at 4.5%? Which one would you prefer? 4.5% treasuries is risk-free. The government's going to give you back your money, even if they have to print it, and they probably are. But the company, at 4.5% dividend yield, they can change their minds tomorrow and say, listen, actually things are tough. We're not going to pay you 4.5%. And you can see this is the conundrum people are sitting with. And then within that, you've had equities that have run very hard for a very for you know since late 2023. And you've just seen these things being toppish at this stage. And people just kind of sitting on the background saying, well, 3.5% inflation, I'm not exactly sure how to model that. And let's just take a step back here from equities just for a little bit until we either see interest rates coming down or alternatively we're seeing earnings accelerating or both potentially. And I think we might see some of that towards the end of this year. We might very well do that.
And what I find fascinating, and we've seen it here in South Africa all the time, so we're used to dealing with inflation, is how the Americans are coming to the realization that salaries are not going to keep up with inflation. We've known that in South Africa. If you want a meaningful salary increase in South Africa, we've known for probably more than 2 decades, you move jobs. Right, it's the only way to get an increase. Whereas in America, you bumbled along, you got an extra 1 or 2%, and you still had the same earning power. But now the sort of the workforce, the bulk of the workforce, they're changing jobs on average every 2.5 to 3 years. I mean, back when I'm sure even when you went into the workforce, it was probably more like 5 or 6 years. When I went into the workforce, it's more like 10, 11, 12 years. And you've got that workforce. And when you get a workforce that is deeply unhappy, it makes it politics really quite difficult. Obviously, then you get the politicians playing into it as well.
There's a strong correlation, Dawn, between rising inflation and the advent of the union. Because obviously, inflation catches employers offside because they're trying to readjust how they're working in a high inflation environment. But the worker at the same time then says, but listen here, I've got real pressures at home. And inflation's running at 4%, and you offering me 2%, that's not going to fly. And then suddenly you see the rise of unionization again. So America is an interesting case in this, where because there's a rise of unionization back in the United States. Whereas in the days of anemic inflation through the 90s and the 2000s, when inflation was running at 2% and 1.5%, why unionize? You don't need it. You're going to get your salary increase. Your cost of capital is so low, you could borrow as much as you want to. You need something, go borrow it. Pay it off over time. Get yourself onto the step ladder as far as home ownership is concerned. And that is what a lot of people have just done over time. And why pay the union fees when that's happening? But suddenly, if inflation runs at 4 or 5%, suddenly people are saying, well, listen, perhaps I should be part of a union now again. And that's what you're seeing as far as that's concerned. How the Americans and the Europeans navigate themselves through this world is going to be very interesting. We're sitting in a changing world, Dawn, and it's a very interesting world. Dawn, just moving across to Asia, there's a fascinating visual which shows Southeast Asia's preferred ally switches in favor of China. And it's interesting because places like Malaysia, Indonesia, Laos, Thailand, where there's more than 50% of the population that are rather side with China than the United States. Places like Cambodia, Myanmar, Singapore, Vietnam, and Philippines will side more with the Americans rather than the Chinese. But there's a large grouping of countries that will just side with the Chinese. And why not? They're in their backyard. Why would you side with people that are on the other side of the world, that you just see from time to time in their military uniforms?
Colby, one of the things that I find really interesting is sort of understanding the differences between capitalism, socialism, and communism, because obviously three completely different notions and they all affect economics at the end of the day. And I found a very interesting story where somebody said, do you want your kids to understand socialism? Get your one child to go and clean, spend 3 hours cleaning the bathroom with a toothbrush, say that you'll pay them $10. You pay them $10, and his younger brother can, you know, sit in the TV room and watch TV. When he's finished doing the bathroom and you've got the $10, you say, okay, but I'm keeping $7 and that's tax, and I'm giving it to your brother who sat on the sofa and did nothing. And then kids will understand what socialism is. And yeah, it's funny, but yeah, it's also not funny. It's actually, it's home.
Absolutely. You see, this is part of the great equalizer should have been in the world, should have been education. You know, that allows you the ability to be able to migrate out of a economic structure or political structure that you just don't believe in. You know, the problem, though, is that even though education equips us to understand the differences, it doesn't necessarily give us the tools in order to leave an economy. So some people are just caught sometimes in these economies, and they just become a byproduct of them. Also, part of the reason, you know, post the Second World War, where the IMF and Bretton Woods and all of these things, they were trying to create a uniformed world where there was equal opportunity, or where opportunity, at least in theory, would trickle down to other economies. I mean, all these things are good things. It just hasn't worked quite that way, because politically, I think countries are on their own quest, and the politics is a byproduct of the social structure in an economy and their immediate past and what they've lived through. South Africa is a great example of this. We all know what the right things are to do in South Africa, but some people vehemently believe in social engineering in South Africa and believe in the National Democratic Revolution. And you can say what you want, and you could show them all reasons why that won't work. And you can show them examples around the world why that won't work. But they'll still believe in it. They'll still say this is the right thing to do. Only the way that changes is with time and with education, ultimately.
And Kobe, I mean, really, is it any different to the sort of diehard MAGA followers of Trump?
No, well, it's not.
They will die on that hill.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd be going to jail for this oak, right? It's
sure.
You
it's
know,
the same
so
thing.
It's messy because you've got people involved. Stocks are great, you know, because they're impersonal. I mean, people do try and ascribe emotions to them. I mean, we talked about that last week a bit. But at the end of the day, the stock exchange is the wealth of mostly the wealthy. The majority of the population, unless they've got pension funds and retirement annuities and all the equivalents across the world, are not participating in that wealth. You know, this is you know, it's an elite, it's at the top there. And yes, it's something that we deal with. And yes, it drives the economy. You know, it's the companies that are creating the GDP that are behind it. But, you know, it's messy.
No, it is. And look, ultimately, the biggest favor that you could do yourself or your kids is equip yourself in such a way in order so that you can participate in the wealth creation mechanisms that are available. What are you going to do in order to do so? What are the steps that you're going to be taking? And you could be thinking about this stuff from the age of 16 and 17. You could already start thinking about these things. You know, what are the steps that you need to be taking? Because if you're not thinking about those things then already, chances are you're not going to be participating in those mechanisms. And look, you could do it sitting in a shack. You could be doing it sitting in a penthouse. You could be doing it anywhere. It's got to do with mindset more than so than your socioeconomic place that you're finding yourself in. With that being said, Dawn, I think we're out of time for this week's newsletter podcast. Well, that's all for the week, folks. This podcast is based on our weekly free newsletter, which you can subscribe to at rexalom.co.za.
All our blogs and newsletters are also available on rexalom.co.za or wealthecology.co.za, and we welcome any suggestions for future topics. Thank you for lending us your ears.